Okay, I wish to thank the organizers of this meeting or several meetings which we have here, and the Fields Institute, and in particular our Chinese colleagues for having me here and to make this event possible in general. Well, what are we talking about is kind of by chance. Some terms ago in Arizona, I gave a class on multi-type epidemic modeling, and I thought that while I was giving the class, I would kind of developing the field or developing the topic. So I didn't know in advance what I was really doing. But I knew there was a large group of papers that started with a paper of 1991 by Stavros Buzenberg and Carlos Castillo Chavez, and then later by Blythe and other people, with a thing which they called the representation formula for pair formation. And then when you look in books like the book by Horst Thieme on population dynamics and the books by Udo Diekmann and his colleagues on epidemic modeling, you always find mentioning of this representation formula, and sometimes the formula is even given, but there's no explanation. And then I started talking to people, and the usual answer was, well, we know this formula, and we know even how it looks like, but we never understood it. And then I asked Carlos Castillo, who is, of course, my colleague and, in a way, my sponsor in Arizona, and I found that after so many years, he didn't quite understand his formula, and Stavros, of course, died prematurely many years ago, and so I started to understand the formula, and in vain. And so part of this lecture is about this formula. But then, of course, you need an introduction to pair formation in general. So I start with some pair formation in general, and then I will intersperse some things I did in the last few weeks to make the thing more comprehensible. But probably I didn't understand it even now. So let's go on. So a tool in studying pair formation and epidemic models in growing populations and things like that is the theory of homogeneous systems. So mathematically, that is a special case of a much wider theory which you find in books on dynamical systems when you have a vector field that is invariant under a group action. And homogeneous systems that appear in biology are a special case where this group is a multiplicative group of positive numbers. So you could put any group of matrix functions and have more complicated things, but we don't need that at the moment. We need only a special case, and we need only a special case of a special case in population dynamics, because usually all our things are restricted to the positive orthon of n space. So that's what I have here. I have a function f that maps the positive cone into the space, and that map f is homogeneous with respect to multiplication by positive numbers, homogeneous of degree 1. And then we have a differential equation, x dot is f of x. And then the first thing we observe is that generically there are no stationary points except 0. So the usual thing, what every student in mass biology does, find stationary points, linearize, blah, 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 that doesn't work. So what are we supposed to look for? We are supposed to look for exponential solutions. So an exponential solution is a vector x hat multiplied by a time-dependent exponential. And that is a typical solution, the interesting solution of such a system. And so in terms of demography, This is just a good old Lotka-Sharpe persistent solution with a given distribution of age classes and exponential growth or decay. Now then, you compute for this function f the Jacobian matrix at this vector of the state vector of the exponential solution. And of course, if you are in n space, you have n eigenvalues. And then you look at the Euler's formulas for homogeneous systems, and you find that the leading eigenvalue in some sense is the exponent of the growing solution. So one eigenvalue is always known. And then you have n minus 1 further eigenvalues. And then the stability condition is not, as usual, that all the real parts should be negative, but the stability condition is that all the real parts should be less than the leading eigenvalue. So in biological terms, this is a good old washout phenomenon, right? You have a population that is growing exponential, and exponential stability means there may be perturbations that even grow exponentially, but they grow at a smaller rate, so as time goes on, they are relatively washed out. So this notion of stability is a stability of proportions, right? It is very similar to a Poincaré map for a periodic motion. Now, we can have another look at this sim. This is what Hostini in his book always does. You normalize your variable by dividing by the total sum ET times X, and then you get a different system that is not homogeneous. This is a Y system there. And that system can be studied on the set of probability vectors. So all vectors that are non-negative and normalized to 1. And when you do that, then exponential solutions become stationary points, and the notion of stability becomes the standard notion of stability for stationary points. So it's a very, in this case, it's a very simple theory. Now, how did I come to this problem? That was in the 1980s when I worked with Klaus Dietz, and it was the beginning of the HIV infection, when HIV was just making the transition from the homosexual core group into the heterosexual population. And we wanted to model two sex populations and interaction, and in particular, we wanted to model the effect that the disease or the spread of the disease would be slowed down by living in faithful pairs. So you would not have random. And then we looked at the literature on pair formation and found that among the demographers, notably by Nathan Kiefitz, but quite a number of other famous people, there were interesting papers on the two-sex marriage problem. And I just mentioned Palette, who was a matrix person, and then Samuelson, who was a Nobel Prize winner in economics. He wrote a very nice paper on this pair formation problem. Now, how looks the classical, what is it? Yeah, then in 1988, with one colleague and one student, I wrote a paper which I believe on this subject of the ODE case is still the most complete presentation. There's a recent book by Mimmo Iannelli and Macheva and Milner on pair formation in two-sex population, which you may look at. So the classical model is very simple. We have females X and males Y and pairs P. So the idea is you do not count married males and married females, but you count pairs. That gives you a little bit more information because you know who is married to whom. And when you do that, then you have this little system here, and the process of birth and the process of death and the process of divorce, these are all linear processes, because typically people get divorced and produce children independent of others. But the process of marriage, of pair formation, is a highly non-linear process, as everybody knows. And So we have here a pair formation function, and that function, this is now the idea, is homogeneous of degree 1. And it has further properties if there are no males or no females, and there can't be any pair formation. And if you add some females to the population, there will be an increase in formation of pairs. So quite natural conditions. And when you impose these properties on the function phi, then you get a three-dimensional homogeneous system, and that can be completely analyzed. And what you find is that there are two one-sex exponential solutions, which are in a way uninteresting because it is the only female which dies out, of course, and the only male which dies out. And then under certain conditions, there may be a two-sex solution where the state vector has all components positive. It shouldn't be a minus, it should be a plus. And the exponent I call lambda hat. Okay. Now, what are the conditions that this two-sex solution exists? And then we can go back to Ross. And Ross made this observation that transmission of disease is kind of analog to marriage or something like that. And when you inspect when does the two-sex solution exist, and you do the mathematics and then start interpreting it, then it just says the two-sex solution exists when the female-only population is unstable with respect to introduction of males, and when, conversely, also the male population is unstable against the infection by females. Okay? So basically, you have a state space which is a kind of wedge, and here is sitting the all-male, and here is sitting the all-female, and if these are both unstable, then the middle you have an attractor, and you can prove that this attractor is a single point. That's the idea behind it. So that's the classical two-sex solution, two-sex solution of the marriage, two-sex marriage problem. Now, the main issue from a modeling point of view is what is the pair formation function? And there is apparently no Q. So when you go from data or from a kind of kinetic analysis, what might happen when young people go to disco and decide to get married, you don't get any cues. So in the literature, you find some established versions. And one is the harmonic mean. This is another way to write the harmonic mean. This is the most established function. But then some authors use also the minimum function. All these functions look like this, more or less. So if you take x plus y equal 1, then these functions look more or less like a parabola or like a triangle hat or something like that. So a decision cannot be made, and so I will stick in the first, going further on, I will stick to the harmonic mean. So now this has been extended to H structure. And that's in the Western literature, I think the first paper is there's a little booklet many years ago, probably from the 1980 or something like that, by Frank Hoppenstedt. It's called the Regional Series of Siam or something like that on population dynamics. And he has the symmetric case where you do not distinguish between females and males. So you get one integral equation only. But then you go to the Russian literature. And there's a very old paper by a man, Staroverov, which is almost never cited and almost never read, but it is very interesting because Staroverov explains in his paper, which is not a mathematical paper, it is a kind of demographic paper, he explains how do you arrive from a kind of mass action kinetics among the sexes eventually, which is homogeneous of degree 2, of course, x times y, how you arrive eventually at a homogeneous of degree 1 system. And most people nowadays, when they do this, I've written here all these equations, which is basically an extension of the Lotka-Sharpe or Mackendrick models to two sexes. And you have X, which are females, which have age A, and you have males that have age B, and of course you have a pair that has an age A for the female and an age B for the male, and then age C, which counts duration of marriage. So it's a time since marriage. And you get into this kind of system, and the interesting question is now, what is the pair formation function? And then in that case, of course, the pair formation function is a function that maps distributions X and Y into a function of the two ages. And most people use this kind of thing, but it took some years before we arrived at this kind of system. And I must say, I spent about a year in trying to prove that this set of partial differential equations with that kind of nonlinearity has an exponential solution where the two sexes coexist, and I failed. But then later came Jan Prys, and with his student Sacher, they gave a first proof. And then Rico Sacher later wrote a paper with a simpler proof, but the simpler proof is still very complicated. And this is one, it's like the nerve axon equation. This is one of these pieces of mathematics which mature to a certain point and then get stopped. So I don't know any further paper on this subject. But if there's a bright young man or woman with some skills in functional analysis and partial differential equations, she or he might be able to give simpler proof for existence and, of course, also a stability proof for this kind of problem. Now you see how pair formation looks like. Basically, you have a numerator that is a product, and you have a denominator that is a sum or weighted sum, and you have a factor, which in this case is rho AB, which somehow counts the attractivity between the sexes of different ages. Actually, in elder times, former times in Germany, we had a table, probably that exists now, for the demography of the nation. And there was a table for the males, and there was a table for the females. But then there was also an annual table of marriages. And it's a beautiful table, right? You have females which going like this from 15 to 105, and similar for the males. And then you have all these boxes with numbers. That's the number of marriages in that year between the different age classes. And then what you see in, say, in 1950, you see a thing which runs very dominant diagonal. And that is the typical marriage of the people who do not go to college at that time, which was a large part of the population, 95% or so. And so you would have a male that is 23 and a woman that is 21, and they got married. So that is a very strict diagonal, dominating. And then the very, very outer corner, you find that 15-year-old girl who married an 80-year-old husband, right? One single. So the matrix looks really like this. Now, that were beautiful times when you wanted to do demography of marriages, because everybody knew what a marriage is, and most people were either married or not married. If I look now at the generation of my children, it is a major disaster, right? You have this part-time partnership with multi-patchwork families, and many people have four children, are not married at all. So all this statistic is gone and cannot be used anymore for epidemic modeling, right? We now must count existing partnership rather than registered marriages. And that is, from a data mining point of view, is much more difficult, of course. How do you do that? People won't answer even. Okay, so as I said, Dietz and I had this idea about immunity by marriage, of course, faithful marriage. And then I make one side remark. In that first paper of ours in 1988, I think, we wrote down an ODE model, not a partial differential equations model. And then we put in real data. And we used the harmonic mean marriage function. And we took the infection rate that were known at that time, or were believed to be known for HIV at that time. And I don't quite remember what we got, but we got a number that in a standard, say, European educated, whatever there is, standard population, if you don't do anything, no condoms, no education, then you can run up to something like about 30% of infected cases. And when we published that, of course, it was published in Journal of Mass Biology, and I was the chief editor, so it was published eventually. But of course, the referee said, the paper was reasonable, so it should have been published, but there was some discussion of this number of 30% up. And people said, this is ridiculous. We have these few cases in the homosexual population, and it is unbelievable that you would have a country where you have 30% infected. And now you go to certain countries in the south of Africa, and you find those numbers, right? And it is not because these people have black skin. The same thing could have happened in Germany if nobody would knew about the disease, and if there would not be any information or education or measures against it. It seems to be that the standard equilibrium is rather high for HIV, and everybody knows that by now. Okay. Now this is pair formation in a changing population, what I'm talking about, right? A totally different thing is pair formation in a given population that is stable. So you just look at a given constant population and you let the pair formation process run in that population. Then you have the previous model as before, but there are no births and no deaths. So it would be the situation, you go to a big dancing hall and people move in and then they form pairs for the evening in a way, right? And then the three-dimensional ODE model reduces to a scalar equation, and that scalar equation, of course, is trivial, and you always get an equilibrium. So that's a much easier problem. And this much easier problem I now want to study in more detail, and I begin with a view, with the goal eventually to arrive at epidemic modeling with a multi-type one-sex model. Not two sexes. Multi-type, all individuals are equal with respect to gender, but nevertheless they form pairs, and we have n different types in the population. And now, what is the model? You see, Y is a symmetric matrix of pairs. It's a little mathematical trick. Rather, you take the pair symmetric, then you stay in the state of symmetric matrices rather than in the set of triangular matrices. And then what happens? X, capital X, that is the diagonal matrix corresponding to the vector X. So you take the components of the vector X and puts them in the diagonal of a matrix. That is capital X. Q is a symmetric matrix of pair formation rate, and C is a symmetric matrix of separation rates. And E is again the vector of all ones. So this here is a product diagonal matrix times symmetric matrix times diagonal matrix, whereas this star is what is called the Aramard product of matrices. That is, the Aramard product of two matrices is just that you multiply them component-wise. You don't add. And that makes sense, because each type of pair Y is multiplied by its own specific separation rate. And so now we have a system in a rather large space. You see, these are matrices and these are vectors. And we want to know what happens. And since we are in the constant population situation, we have an invariant of motion. And that is all the married people plus all the non-married people, in a way. And this gives a constant vector, and that is the vector of type densities. And now I want to know what can be said mathematically about such a problem. And it looks extremely simple, right? Just some matrix multiplication. And the first interesting observation is that the one-type two-sex model is a special case. So if you choose your matrix Q like this here, with zeros in the diagonal, and the matrix C as all the separation rates, then you arrive at the two-sex problem. And I have written, should be true in general, which means probably, I didn't work it out, but probably all two-sex models can be written as one-sex models if you do that in an appropriate matrix formulation. Maybe that's something for next week. Now, then I wanted to prove something. And using degree theory, I could prove that there is always, whatever your type vector is, if all types are present, your type vector is positive, then there is at least one equilibrium. And if your type vector has zeros, that means that certain types do not exist in your model, then you get equilibria which also have some zeros. So altogether there are 2 to the n minus 1 equilibria. And for n equal 2, with some effort, I could prove that the equilibrium is unique and globally attractive. And that was already a two-page proof. So I don't know how to do the general case. That's another open problem. And then I think for our purposes here, it might be interesting to look at the case where there's no separation. So where eventually all singles are eaten up, so to say. And then, of course, the matrix C is not there. And you have this system, and you have this system. And your initial data is, of course, you have no pairs to begin with, and each type is single. And then what you can prove, of course, that the pairs converge to some positive matrix, and the singles converge to zero. And that matrix eventually has the property that A times the vector of all ones is the vector of types, which just is preservation of types. And then you have an equivalent formulation. In this equation for x, you can get rid of the y. And if you look at this equation, this looks very, very similar to these equations by Maynard Smith and Taylor and Yonker of evolutionary game dynamics. And I guess there is some mathematical connection behind it. And so these are the equations that should be studied. We know that the thing converges. But what we need, and what I didn't find out so far, is a nice relation between the pair formation matrix Q and the matrix A that counts the existence pairs at the time the disco closes, so towards the end of the pair formation process. And I guess in the literature by some people in Vienna, there's a very old paper that gives a kind of explicit solution for the Taylor-Yonker price equation, and maybe there is some relation. That will be the next open problem to be studied. Now, this, what I'm talking about so far, is dynamic pair formation. That is, you have a population, you open the disco, people are moving in, people are forming pairs, and either never get separated towards T infinity, or they get separated and you go to some equilibrium. Another thing, a totally different problem, is when you say, here I have a group of people, and everybody is forced to enter a pair, and nobody is allowed to have two mates. That is what I call stationary pair formation, or immediate pair formation, or complete pair formation. And that's actually, if you look at it, is what Duesenberg and Castillo and these people studied in the 90s. And so basically, you forget about the dynamics I told you before, but you suppose the matrix A is given. So what is then your matrix? It is a non-negative symmetric matrix and has a property that if you sum up the rows or columns, then you arrive at the vector of sizes. And now we are really in the middle of biology. There's a huge set of such matrices. There's a big polyhedron in matrix space. And we want to make choices which have a meaning for biology and for epidemiology. So what are good choices? Now, to formulate that problem, I am now going to a normalized way. I assume that the vector of types is a probability vector P. So just the sum is 1. And then complete pair formation is nothing else than a symmetric matrix with this property. Now, if you go into the literature on this problem, you find there's a lot. You see, many of these papers are vague, right? The papers in demographic journals and in whatever. And you find that basically there are two different notions. One is you have a vector P that is given, and you want all these matrices and make intelligent choices. And then, of course, you know that the set of all these matrices is a convex polyhedron, and then the first view would be look for extremal points of the polyhedron or something like that. But then there's another view in the literature which says we want a formula. And what is a formula? A formula is a matrix function that takes any probability distribution and gives a meaningful pair formation matrix to it. And you see that most people look at this finding formulas. Now let's see whether we can find a formula. Now you go to these papers by Busenberg and company, and you find a formula. Looks like this. What is phi? I don't know what phi is. But the formula does a job. So now I'm at the point where I was about a year ago. And now comes, how can one understand such a formula? So you see, phi is a symmetric matrices. All entries are smaller than 1. And then you take that matrix phi, and you enter a rank 1 perturbation. And then from both sides, you multiply with the diagonal matrix of the p's. And that gives a formula. That is a pair formation matrix. Now, can you understand that formula? I could talk for several hours now about what people did and what relations between different matrices are, but it's too long. That will be a class. It's not in presentation. So what I did, you see, if you choose phi equals 0, then you got what people call random pair formation. You know that in the literature, random, in the biological literature, random does not mean random, but it means uniform, right? It's a kind of very bad thing. When biologists say this is random mating, they mean random mixing means actually a uniform distribution. And of course, every distribution is a random variable result. So I should mention that when I came up in Arizona with this problem, Carlos Castillo got a little bit upset. And I expected to him to be here, I would say the same thing if he were here. And he started immediately researching on his old papers. And he gave a PhD student a subject. Ben Morin is a rather bright student. He was in my classes. Very, very interesting student. And he immediately jumped on this problem. And he has written with Carlos and some others a nice paper on this subject. But it's very different from I will be talking to you. So I have a totally, now after half a year or a year or so, I have a totally different view on this subject. The underlying problem is the following. You have a substochastic matrix that is called psi. So substochastic means it's non-negative, and the columns sums add up to something that is less or equal to 1. And then you want to complement that substochastic matrix to a stochastic matrix. So you are looking for a matrix A that is not less than this psi, and which is, so of course psi is non-negative, so this guy is non-negative, and then it is stochastic. Stochastic in my case means always you add to column stochastic. So I last winter I was the John von Neumann professor in Technical University of Munich, and I was invited to the other university, the what do you call that, Ludwig Maximilian, the abstract university of Munich, and the real university, not the technical one, and by the stochastic people. And I asked them about this problem, and apparently within the stochastic process community, this problem has not come up. So now comes a proposition. You see, S is this set of these matrices we are looking for. And in a way, now comes the answer to the problem. It says the matrices in this set can be all represented in the following form. You take the matrix phi, and you take the vector E minus psi transpose E, and put its element in a diagonal, and multiply it from the left by a diagonal matrix whose diagonal is a probability distribution. These are all. This is a parameterization of this set. And if you look at the problem element-wise, no, that's not correct what I said. X is an arbitrary matrix whose columns are probability distributions, and this thing is multiplied by a diagonal. So the elements look, aij is psi ij plus xij, so the columns add up to 1, and this guy is non-negative, and then it's multiplied by this factor here. Now, what is the stochastic interpretation of this formula? This formula says, given the substochastic matrix psi, then you compute these numbers. And that is the probability mass for J that has not been allocated by the matrix psi. So it's a remaining probability mass. And the columns of the matrix X that are probability distributions tell you how this remaining mass or superfluous mass is distributed to the other states. Does it make sense? And you see, this is a very nice formula in so far as there is no denominator, right? It is just a product. And now, of course, you have special choices. And one choice is you take the state J and you take the remaining probability mass for that state, and you allocate it to the state J itself. Algebraically, that says you take all the remaining mass and put it as a diagonal. So you take your matrix psi and add a diagonal matrix, and the elements of that diagonal matrix are these defect numbers, the remaining probability mass. I didn't find any application for that. It's a nice formula, but now comes the second way. Use the same probability distribution, lowercase x, for all states j. Then the formula we had before reduces to take the matrix psi and add a dyadic product. And the left factor is a column vector, which is a given probability distribution, and the right is a row vector that is a vector of defect. So in that case, you see, the matrix A is a rank 1 perturbation of the matrix psi, where, of course, if psi is already stochastic, then the perturbation is 0. Okay. Now, this formula is at the bottom of what Duesenberg and Castillo-Chavez did. So what we got now is a probabilistic interpretation of this strange matrix. There is no geometric interpretation. So you see, there's only an algebraic interpretation, or it says it is the only rank one perturbation that exists. And there is a probabilistic interpretation that says it comes out if you choose the same distribution for all states. But if you look at this element in the set of all matrices A in the polyhedron, these matrices are sitting right in the middle. No extremal points or something like that. That's kind of interesting. But I am quite satisfied with a probabilistic interpretation. Now, I said it is at the bottom of this problem of pair formation, but it is not yet the problem of pair formation. Because now I must ask a more sophisticated question. Can the matrix psi be complemented to a stochastic matrix A with given stationary distribution? So the matrix should not be bigger than psi and stochastic, but it should have a given stationary distribution. And then assume that the matrix psi is not already stochastic and does not have P as an eigenvector, and then you come up with a formula like this. And now we are already very close at the pair formation formula, because, and we are even in a more general setting, because here the matrix A in all this theory does not need to be symmetric, can be any. Now the next step is now towards the biological interpretation. So you have, now we leave stochastics, we go from probability distribution to population density. So we have n groups with sizes pi that add up to 1. An individual in group I has a preference for individuals in group j, and that preference is phi, not psi. These guys need not be symmetric, but it should be all less than 1. With this interpretation, the product pi times phi ij is the total preference in the group I for the group j. And then the question is, can we find a stochastic matrix A that respects the preferences and also respects the group size distribution? And this is more or less the problem I had stated before, and more or less the same answer. Well, this is just a mathematical formulation of the hypothesis. And what we get is the matrix phi is the matrix of preferences. But the matrix is any non-negative matrix whose elements are less than 1. But then P multiplied by phi, that is a substochastic matrix. And by what we had before, under certain conditions, this can be complemented to a stochastic matrix. And if we ask for the rank one perturbation, then we come to this formula. And that is basically the pair formation formula, if we restrict to the symmetric case. Well, to end this chapter, I will just mention the scenario of Duesenberg and Castillo-Chavez. So we have n groups. And an individual group I makes contacts per time, Ci, and gamma ij is the probability that such contact is with an individual of group j. And then basically, if we take the Ci or equal to 1, we have the problem I have just mentioned. And if we do, well, the case of different Ci is some kind of rescaling of the formula. So as a result, I skipped some slides, we can say that the pair formation problem is a special case of this preference theory in the case where the matrix is symmetric. And I think this theory of preferences makes much more sense in a way, because we really understand what people are doing, right? People are doing, they go into a disco and have certain preferences, and then they try to satisfy these preferences, because at the end of the day, everybody wants to have a friend. And then they use certain probability distributions for making this complementation to a stochastic matrix. That's the underlying idea. Okay, now, as I said before, we want to relate somehow these things to epidemic models. And of course, you can take the contact term in an epidemic model and interpret as a pair formation thing. If I would do that now, you would be bothered by a lot of formulas. Therefore, I use the pair formation model that has been on the screen already in two talks, and it's here. So we have n types of social groups, and they are stable, so they are not changed by infection, but just a susceptible in a group gets infected, stays in the same group, recovers, stays in the same group. So we have vectors for different, n is the number of types, of course, x plus y plus z, and they add up to a probability vector p. And then our system is basically the Kermack-McKendrick problem for n types in a constant population, such that I do not need to write the denominator, right? So B is the matrix of transmissions. Y is the vector of infected. Lowercase x would be the vector of susceptible. Uppercase x is the diagonal matrix of the vector x. D is the recovery matrix. So x is susceptible, y is infected, z is recovered. And of course, we start from the population where x is more or less p, y is almost zero, and z is zero. So we look at that one trajectory, which starts from the uninfected population. And now the question is, what can we say? The first thing is, of course, we compute the basic reproduction number, and by whatever formula you use, you come up with the basic reproduction number is the spectral radius of a product. And the product has in the middle the B, that is the transmission matrix, and to the left the diagonal matrix P, and to the right D to the minus 1 recovery matrix. Now, in a real biological setting, the matrix B may depend on the vector P itself. I don't go into that. Now comes the strange thing. Fanadrisha and Watmore and me, some years ago, we tried to write a paper on basic reproduction number, and then came up the problem of whether this kind of models have an invariant of motion, like the scalar Kermack-McKendrick model with the logarithm. And for some reason, we didn't succeed. Pauline also doesn't quite recover what happened, right? We somehow didn't. And yesterday, I found it is trivial. So there is a vector-valued invariant of motion, and it is exactly the thing which you know from Kermack-McKendrick, but in Kermack-McKendrick, you typically write somewhere alpha over beta here. But here it's just the matrix B times D to the minus 1 applied to Y plus the same matrix applied to X minus the vector of logarithms. That's the basic reproduction. That is the invariant of motion. And then you can rather easily show that the susceptible go to a limit, and that the infected go to zero, and that the recovered go to a limit. And then the invariant of motion, since you know where you started from, gives you a vector valued equation for the finer size of the population. So for the finer size of the susceptible part of the population, which in this case is a vector. And then you look at this kind of thing and you say, oh, this is linear, this is a logarithm. If these were scalars, it would be a convex function, right? And then you would see there's one solution which is P, and there must be another solution if the basic reproduction number is bigger than 1. And the same is true in the vector valued case. There is a famous theory of Krasnoselsky for Krasnoselsky convex. Of course, he didn't call it that way, but we call it now Krasnoselsky convex equations. And you can prove that there, in case the basic reproduction number is bigger than 1, that there is a unique solution for the remaining susceptible. So that's what typically called is S infinity. Now, this is a side remark. In one talk yesterday, it was mentioned a paper by Hasi-Bader and somebody else where you take the basic reproduction number on depending on parameters, and you maximize over the parameters to get the worst case. What we did with Ludwig Elsner from Bielefeld, who is a frequent co-author of Pauline Fahnenbrüche, we looked at the following problem. You assume you know the matrix B and you know the matrix D, and you ask for the worst distribution of types, which maximizes the basic reproduction number. And we got a theory for that, and it's a beautiful mathematical result because it relates this epidemic problem or pseudo-epidemic problem to the so-called theory of max algebra, on which Pauline Fahnenbrüche wrote several papers with other people. Well, we showed this to Oro Diekmann. He said it's complete nonsense. Typically, in real epidemics, you know your distribution of types, but you do not know the interaction matrix, whereas here we assume the interaction matrix is known and we do not know the distribution of types. So in a way, we take the view of going by rocket to a distant planet, and we know already how the people behave if they exist, but we don't whether they exist. We don't know whether they exist, and then we take the worst case. Well, that's just a side remark. That's ongoing work. If somebody is interested in this piece of mathematics, I can tell. Probably this theory is more appropriate for the so-called linear model in economy rather than for epidemic diseases. Now I come to the last little chapter. When I was sitting in Tübingen, I got a mail from one of the organizers here and said, could you please say something about resistant strains in epidemiology? And I had worked on that never. I just sat down and I wrote down a little model and tried to explain to myself where the problem is. Of course, there are numerous problems from a biological point of view, from an immunological point of view, and what is going really on in the hospital or in nature. And probably what I'm telling you is already in 50 different papers published in Math, Biosciences, and everywhere else. But anyway, I think it is nice looking at the problem again. So what I'm doing is I have normal strain, I1 and I2. Now, I1 is the normal strain without treatment, and I2 is the normal strain treated. And then I have I3, that is the resistant strain in an untreated environment, and I4, that is the resistant strain in a treated environment. And then you see the model is just constant input and S times blah, blah, blah. We have seen that several times. And the only interesting point is that the normal strain is produced by the treated and by the non-treated with perhaps different rates, and the recoveries is moved out. And then there's the transition kappa, which is the treatment rate. There comes the first caveat, right? everything is wrong about this model, right? Probably you should not make a model for individuals that are infected, but you should make a model for parasites. That's one. Then probably you should allow for double infection, super infection, so there should be many more types in the model. And then I do the same thing for the other strain. And then, of course, there are four different recombination numbers. And then you observe the following. This six-dimensional model, right? You have four types of infected, and you have the recovered, and you have susceptible, with four different basic reproduction numbers, is on the one hand a generalization of the Kermack-McKendrick model. But on the other hand, it's a generalization of the chemostat. So there are two effects. There is this threshold behavior, which we know from Kermack-McKendrick, but there's also competitive exclusion, what we know from the chemostat. And so where are the interesting parameters? The interesting parameters are, of course, these four basic reproduction numbers. But on the one hand, it is interesting whether one basic reproduction number dominates another one. That is a competitive exclusion argument. And on the other hand, it is interesting whether a basic reproduction number is bigger or smaller than one. That is a Kermack-McKendrick view. And so I make the assumption that the normal strain without treatment has a basic reproduction number bigger than one. If not, we wouldn't treat it. And that with treatment, its basic reproduction number is smaller than one. If not, we wouldn't treat it. Okay? Then we assume that the resistant type, under normal conditions, without treatment, is inferior. Now, this is a very important point from a biological point of view. So when you do things like weeds in a cornfield or something like that, then it is typical that the resistant strain is not dominating under normal conditions. So it would not be dominant in the wild. But the resistant strain becomes only dominant under treatment. And the question is whether, if you have in a hospital a resistant strain, is it true that under standard conditions in the wild, that type would be inferior? Or is it true that this resistant type has all the properties and strengths of the normal type and just the additional property to be resistant? I don't know. I would think, whatever I know from biology of higher plants and things like that, that being resistant comes at an expense. And so if you look at higher plants, when the threat is over, they stop being resistant, because being resistant is expensive. And I could imagine the same is true for microorganisms. So that's this assumption. Then I assume that R4 is bigger than R3, and R4 is bigger than 1. If these were not true, we wouldn't have a problem in the first place. And now comes the problem. We ask, is there a window for the policy of treatment that would do two things? In a way, it would still have the property that the normal strain dominates the resistant strain, but on the other hand, that the treatment gets the normal strain down. And if you think of it, and you say that cannot be true in general. That cannot be true in general. You need that without treatment, the resistance strain is not only inferior to the normal strain, but it has also basic reproduction number one, less than one. And if that is true, then there's one further condition, and there is such a window. Now, I think this model belongs to the class of very elementary, almost rudimentary, caricature models, which does not grasp all biologically relevant features, but it may be kind of starting point to look at the problem of resistance. It's a very simplistic model, but for the moment I cannot do better. So that's the end of the talk. Thank you very much for your attention.